This episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast is proudly supported by AQA. AQA want you to know about all the things they've put in place to ensure your students' summer 23 GCSE maths exams were the best exams they could be to allow your students to shine. So what did they do? Well, I've picked out four things here that interested me. Number one, multiple choice questions were removed from the beginning of the papers and replaced with some lovely opening settling questions so that even your weaker students could have a go, succeed, and carry that momentum through the rest of the paper. So important, that start of an exam. Number two, the wording, context, and ramping of demand in the questions were all carefully considered. Number three, past questions were looked at scientifically in terms of performance to inform the question choice for summer 23. And finally, AQA have got together with some of the very best assessment expertise for mathematics in the whole wide world who work non-stop to try and get the best possible assessments for you. But that's all well and good, but did it actually work? Well, of course, the results from summer 23 are in. So we can reveal that 60% of foundation tier students achieved half marks or more across the exam, compared to just 33% in 2019 before the pandemic. And in the higher tier, over 65% scored over half marks, compared to 46% in 2019. So it's looking good. Head over to aqa.org.uk/discovermaths to book a call with one of AQA's team of experts and find out why you should consider switching to AQA for GCSE maths. That's aqa.org.uk/discovermaths, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Welcome to another episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast with me, Craig Barton, a show where I interview people who interest and inspire me from the wonderful world of education. This is the seventh in the series of monthly conversations with my good friend and podcasting enemy, the fantastic Ollie Lovell. Each time we reflect on three things we've tried, seen, or been thinking about in the last month. And this is one of my favourites. So what did we discuss? Well, Ollie reflects on how he thinks it's important to plan CPD around the in-between times. I then continue the CPD theme by sharing some questions I think it's useful for teachers to ask themselves when they're taking part in CPD. Ollie then reflects upon one of my tips from my Tips for Teachers book, still available in all good and evil bookstores, about asking who got 8 out of 10. I then explain my recent revelation about the importance of rehearsal when coaching. Ollie then talks us through the importance of moving slowly. And finally, I consider what's harder for a novice teacher, planning lessons from scratch or adapting existing lessons. I absolutely love these monthly conversations with Ollie, you know. It's just a great vehicle for me selfishly to just test out some of the things that I've been thinking about, see if they've got anything about them. And Ollie always has some good insights that he can share that makes me refine my thinking. It's hard for me to say nice things about him, you know, but he is pretty good. Anyway, just before we dive in, a quick reminder to sign up for my two newsletters. That's the Tips for Teachers newsletter and the ED newsletter. They're both free and they're both the vehicles that I use to share my most recent thinking. You'll find links to those in the show notes. Enjoy. Ollie Lovell, how are you, mate?
Good, Craig. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Just saying, just before we hit record, that's the first time you've answered that with a positive reply in a good few episodes. You've been struggling, haven't you, in the previous ones? But you're looking very fresh today. What's going on?
Feeling all right. I think it was only one episode, the last one that we were struggling, that I was struggling, the royal we, should I say. And that was mainly because you got me up was it 5:30 or maybe 6 a.m. Episode, that one? So I'm just blaming you for that one, Craig. But I am doing well, despite being very, very tired after what I've just finished, which was two weeks kind of traveling around Australia with Josh Goodrich, Harry Fletcher Wood, and Sam Sims running a whole heap of trainings. Trying to keep up with those three was a bit of a challenge. They're very, very energetic people and amazing guys. And so I was pretty shattered after that, but I went back to my parents' place where Holly had been for the previous week and had a good sleep over the weekend, and I'm feeling much rejuvenated now.
How did it all go? How was the tour?
It was great. It was heaps of fun. We had over 100 people at the first three events, and then about 60 at the fourth, but we only advertised the fourth one with about a month out, so we were really happy with that. And yeah, it was great. A big emphasis on rehearsal, Craig. It's one of our favorite things. So we had people up for a good amount of the training, like actually practicing coaching techniques and things like that. And yeah, the feedback was really great. We learned a heap from running it and refined a lot of ideas through the process, and had a lot of fun along the way.
Oh, nice one. And rehearsal is going to come up on one of my things I want to talk to you about a little bit.
Awesome. How about you, Craig? How have you been?
Good. Busy. Visiting loads of schools, learning loads of things. But here's something we haven't talked about for a while, right? Do you remember how my sleep was messed up? Because Isaac, my four-year-old, would just come in every night and wake me up, and I just couldn't be bothered, so I just said, get in bed. Well, mm-hmm. I've solved it. And I'm thinking, I reckon I could get a book out of this, and the book would be called Give Them a Quid. Because the way I've solved it is I just pay him. So every night he doesn't come in, he gets a pound in the morning. And I'm about 65 quid down on this. But if you think, would I pay £65 for, some kind of miracle cure that got me, 65 good sleeps? Of course I would. So I reckon, but the thing is, he's onto this now. So I think he could probably just sleep through the night just without this incentive, but he wants his pound every time. But so worst case is going to cost me 365 quid a year, possibly up till he's the age of 18 or something. But I think I'm willing to take the hit. So who'd have known it? That extrinsic motivation was all I needed.
There you go. So when you set up this contract, you didn't specify an end date?
Big error. Yeah. So he just wakes up every morning and he calls it a gold coin. He says, Daddy, where's my gold coin? So I have to give him He's absolutely rolling in the cash, absolutely reloaded now.
But there you go.
Yeah, we're both sleeping better. So
that makes a lot of sense from your perspective, in that, it's worth paying a pound to be able to sleep through the night. But I think flipping around the other way, it's also kind of sad that Isaac would rather have a pound than hug his father.
Let's not go down that road. Let's not go down that road. I'll have to pay him for a hug in the morning. I'll be £2 down. But yeah, we'll be fine.
I like that.
Right, mate. So for listeners who don't know, every month, Holly and I get together and we share three things that we've been thinking about or trying in the last month or so. And we pitch them to each other and see what happens from there. So Ollie, what is the first thing you've got on your list today?
I just wanted to say, last time, because I tried to do a bit of a follow-up at the start from things you said you were going to do or things like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
And this might actually be in one of your... Well, there's two things I want to follow up on. This might already be in your takeaway, but you wrote to me in an email, I've got a good coaching rehearsal story for you. I'll tell you on the potty. Is that today?
Yeah, that's number two for me, yeah.
The other thing is, I wanted to ask how your Huberman workouts are going, because I got all inspired after you and made a plan and then did it, I think, once and then haven't done it since. How are you going with it?
Well, you'll be loving this, because we're going to talk about this, but we're going to talk about this in the bonus question for your Patreon. So a little teaser here up front is each month, Ollie, me and Ollie record after the kind of main episode's finished, and Ollie releases that to his Patreons, and we each pick a question to answer. So this week's question I've come up with, and that is, what is one episode of a non-educational podcast that you think teachers should listen to? And a little spoiler alert, I'm going to talk about one of Huberman's, and it's all to do with this exercise routine. And just to give listeners a little bit of a teaser, it's a game changer, this, all you know. The thing is, I'm old. You're not old. So I'm 41 now. You're about 22 or something like that, right? So I'm feeling it. I need to do these things to kind of keep fit. So I've been doing a lot of strength training, a lot of zone two. I've been doing a thing called rooking that I'm going to be talking to you about as well in the bonus podcast. So yeah, I'm sticking to it. It's a bit harder when I'm traveling, but I force myself to either do a walk or a run and then just some kind of body weight stuff. But it's much harder when I'm traveling, but it's been the best fitness routine I've had so far. So you need to get back into it all.
I've got it printed out somewhere behind me, but yeah, printed out and now it's gathering dust. But I really look forward to talking to you about that because I'm keen to do a better job of that myself.
Right, we'll take a deep dive in the bonus pod. Perfect. Right. That sounds
good. Can't wait.
All right, mate, what are you going for number one?
All right, my number one takeaway is plan professional development around getting the most out of the between times. So one of my favorite days while Josh, Harry, and Sam were in Australia recently was a day we had off in Sydney. And in the morning, Josh went for one of his usual 20K runs. I was far too tired to join him on that. But instead, Harry Fletcher Wood and I went for a big walk. And we had a talk about designing professional development. And this is because they've just finished or they've just started the second cohort of the StepLab Certificate in Coaching Leadership in the UK, which is basically a course where they train coaches how to lead other coaches in their school context. And it's been hugely successful. And obviously, Harry Fletcher Wood has designed a lot of highly successful training over the years for Ambition and other organizations. And so I basically had a 2-hour walk with Harry Fletcher Wood being like, "So Harry, share all your wisdom with me about how to run effective PD." It was amazing. And then we had another 2-hour chat another day as well. But one of the main things I took out of this was this idea, plan professional development around getting the most out of the between times. So what Harry says here is the majority of the time that people are getting better is not going to be when they're with you in that room because you only have them for a very limited amount of time. So what you should be doing is really planning, what can I do in this PD that I'm running with them live to prepare them to get the most out of the in-between time? So an example of that is a big part of the certificate in coaching leadership is these kind of group accountability calls. And these are calls with, you know, 3, 4, 5 people who are each leading coaching in their context. And they come in, there's always a focus and there's a really, really structured way that they kind of have these calls. There has to be a chair, which is one of the people in the group, and so on and so forth. Now, without kind of really training people and spending quite a bit of time helping people to use that time effectively, those meetings can kind of deteriorate into one person dominates, the other people kind of don't have a good time, and then they decide not to come to the next one, and suddenly you've got this negative momentum. But if they want run really effectively, then you get this positive momentum. Everyone feels like they're getting heaps of out of it. They're building stronger relationships. They're building more momentum and so on, being held accountable. And so one of the things I've done in the certificate in line with this principle is basically run practice meetings whilst Harry and the other facilitators can walk around, monitor them, give tips, give feedback, do it. Or you can run it like it's a fishbowl activity where a group in the middle is having the meeting and people sit around the outside. That's just one example, but I thought this principle is a really, really powerful one. I think some of the teachers who probably already do this really, really well is music or instrument teachers, because they probably only see their pupil for an hour a week, and you know, you can only do a very limited amount in that amount of time. So it's like, what can I do to set you up motivationally and skills and knowledge-wise to be successful in your practice? And I think it also relates to a couple of ideas. Our head of department, it was pretty cool today. The reading that he set for us in our team meeting was actually Peps McRae's article on upstream thinking. What can you do upstream or systematically to lead to better downstream consequences? So I think that idea kind of relates to this as well a little bit, as well as kind of my favorite area of education of self-regulated learning. So I think it's powerful on a lot of levels. I just thought that was a really good takeaway.
It's lovely that, mate. So yeah, a few things on this. So I first heard, I think it was Dylan, like everything goes back to Dylan William, right? Like outside of education, it's Oscar Wilde. Inside education, it's Dylan William. So I heard Dylan say that teachers should learn a lot from music teachers. And he's, I think it like peripatetic is like the posh word for it. Someone who just kind of dips into a school just kind of once a week, does a half hour session on the violin or the piano. And then the key is training the students to know how to practice in between, because that's where the learning is going to take place. And Dylan's point was that teachers should try put a lot more focus into making students know how to do the practice and learning outside of lessons. But also on your point, it's so important for PD, right? That, as you say, the learning's not going to take place in the half hour, 1 hour that you've got the teachers together. It's going to take place in the 50 lessons that they do in between. So I think that's a really smart framing. I like that. So I've got a story on this, right? This is a heartbreaker. This, are you ready for this?
Yeah.
So I was last academic year, I visited a school and I did one of my kind of one day, in fact, it was 2 days, kind of in school support where I work with a maths department, watch a load of lessons, get everybody together in the afternoon. We do something bespoke based on what I've seen in the morning. And then the following day, I watch it in action. And this particular school, they were in a bit of a state. They were struggling, high staff turnover and so on and so forth. Head of department was off on long-term sick. It was challenging circumstances, but the session seemed to go really well. My 2 days, and they were kind of nodding away, and we did a lot of mini whiteboard stuff and checking for understanding. And teachers are really good at nodding and telling you, yeah, I'm going to do this. But for one reason or another, I couldn't go back in until this academic year. So it'd been probably about, say, 9 months in between, 8 months, something like that. And you know what's going to happen, right? I went in and it was like I'd never been. It's like didn't see one. They even knew I was coming in. They didn't even bother getting the mini whiteboards out just as a token gesture. There was nothing all. And it really hammered home the importance of, from my perspective, and this feeds into a call I've just taken before I jumped on this call with you. Whenever I'm organizing to do school support and CPD, my question I always ask for the organizer is, what's going to happen once I go? Once I go away, how are you going to sustain this? What's going to be your internal process for making sure that two things happen? Staff are giving things a go, and also you share good practice. When you identify people who are managing to make these change, how are you going to get other people into their lessons to watch and so on? And it's very rare that somebody's considered this, because they think the magic's all going to happen in this, you know, 1 hour or one day that they're doing the PD. But as you say, I love that. It's the in-between times where it makes all the difference. So yeah, you bang on with this all. So there's just a kind of a couple of reflections from me. I don't know if you've got anything to add to that.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, I've been thinking about the kind of PD that I do from time to time recently a lot too, reflecting upon this. And I mean, that is a depressing story you tell, but I'm sure it's the same as the story I would tell if I actually did go into a lot of the schools that I touch on or that I visit. Which is why I'm like super excited about launching this certificate next year in Australia, because I mean, something else Harry says, which is pretty simple but quite profound, like things only happen in schools. Usually things only happen in schools if one particular person really drives it. They've got to have a fire in their belly. And so this model of like finding that one person in the school who does have the fire in their belly, stoking it, and then providing them with the skills, knowledge, and support over a year to actually implement something. Like, I've never done anything like that before. And I just think it has such potential to really generate powerful change. And so I'm going to be trying to do more and more PD of that format in the future, I think, moving forwards, because I think that's what's really going to have the biggest impact.
That's great. Please fill us in on that, because I'm super interested in this, how you sustain that kind of good practice and share it around. That's lovely.
Great.
Good start. And I'll tell you what, my second idea, a bit related to this, you know, because I've got a bit of a PD thing I wanted to share with you, right?
Fantastic.
So strap yourselves in for this one. So anytime I deliver, you know, CPD, so not kind of departmental specific school visits, but when like I'm hired to do a talk or a workshop or a day's inset or something, my format of my CPD mirrors my Tips for Teachers book. So for people who haven't read it, what I do is I pick a theme, whether it be mini whiteboards or responsive teaching or the start of the lesson, and I share a load of ideas, sometimes 10 ideas, 15 ideas, whatever, all on that theme. And I kind of go through them all. And then I put them all on the board at the end of, you know, that 15, 20 minutes. And then I throw it open to the delegates who are there. And prior to what I'm going to say to you now, here's what I always said. I said, right, there'll be some ideas on this board that you think are the worst thing you've ever heard. So forget them. There are some ideas on this board that you think, I already do that. So forget them. But there may be one or two ideas that you think, you know what, there's something in that. Those are the ideas I want you to discuss. And I always thought, well, that's fine, because I want people to focus in on the ideas that they think are particularly interested, so you get buy-in and so on and so forth. But one night, I just randomly, I don't know what happened here, I just woke up about 2 a.m. and I couldn't get back to sleep. And I started thinking about this and I thought, you know what, I'm missing a trick there. That I don't want people just dismissing ideas that they already do. I don't want them just dismissing or not thinking about ideas that they just don't like. So I started working on a different framework. So let me pitch this to you all, right? So let me imagine that you're someone in my CPD session. And let's say, for example, the CPD has been on homework, how to make homework effective, which is something I've been talking about at the moment. And let's say I go through 11 ideas that I think could improve homework. And I'll put all 11 ideas on the board. Instead of getting you to focus on particular ideas, what I'm actually going to ask you to do is to consider all ideas, but I want you to think where they fit in this particular graph I'm going to describe to you now, right? So imagine we've got two axes. So I've got this written down here just so I don't mess this up, right? So on the horizontal axis, we've got how closely this matches with what you currently do. So in other words, this is a measure of the kind of amount of change you'd need to make to build this into your practice. Okay, so how closely does this match with what you're currently doing? That's the x-axis. On the y-axis, we've got the likely impact upon learning. Okay, so how big a change, positive change, do you think this is going to make to your students? And then what I've done is I've divided it into quadrants. Okay. So if we take the top right quadrant first, this is something that you think is going to have a big impact on your student learning. But you know what? It's really close to what you already do. Now, in the past, I'd have said, well, forget it, because you're already doing it. But now my question I ask is, can you do it more? So you found something you're already doing. You know it's got a positive impact on learning. So what I want you to do with that idea is, are you doing it enough? Can you do it more with that particular class? Or can you do it more with different classes? So that's how I'd kind of get you to frame an idea that fit into that top right quadrant, okay? If we go bottom right now, so here we've got something that is really close to something you already do, but you think it's quite low down in terms of the likely positive impact on learning. The question I'm going to ask you there is, can you do it better? So you're already doing it, but can you make a little tweak that actually takes this from something for being relatively low impact to actually this is something that's got quite a powerful, profound impact? Okay, so that's bottom right. So any idea that fits in there, I want to ask, can you do it better? Let's go top left now. So we've got something that's got a likely high impact on learning, but it doesn't closely match to something you're already doing. So here, this is the thing I'd always get teachers to focus on in the past. The question I'm asking here is, what would I need to change to make this work for me? And that might be something you need to change about your own practice to build in this new idea, or it might be something you need to change about the idea itself to make it fit into your practice. But here you're going to need a bit of effort. I believe in this idea because it's high up on the y-axis. What do I need to change to make it work for me? Okay, so that's top left. Bottom left, and I'll shut up after this. Bottom left, you've got something that is not very close to what you currently do, and you don't think it's going to have a high impact on learning. So instead of getting you to dismiss this, the question I want you to ask here is why? Why do you believe that? Why don't you do it? And why don't you think it has a positive impact on learning? And the chances are you might have valid reasons for that, because I don't believe in this, this, and this, which is fine. But also, I think what that might reveal is that perhaps you've never considered it before, that actually when you start asking that question why, and then you start particularly speaking to a colleague who perhaps puts it on a different place on this graph, all of a sudden, maybe there might be something in that. So to cut a long story short, and I've not had a chance to experiment with this yet, because as I say, it kind of came to me in a bit of a nightmare, or I don't know what you'd describe it as. But when I go through my tips, I'm going to ask people to essentially sort the ideas into these quadrants and then ask themselves, can I do it more? Can I do it better? What would I need to change to make it work and why? What do you think of that all?
Thanks for sharing. Okay, that's really interesting. And it's you're getting these new layers of ideas at night now that you wake up and you're alone in bed rather than Isaac and you're talking about, what were you talking about last time? Whether monkeys have nipples or something like that.
Exactly,
I can't remember.
Right. Exactly right. Yeah. That's crazy. It. So the thoughts have changed a bit. Yeah.
That has shifted. Yeah, no, I really like it. I think the idea of not dismissing things or not giving people that out, I really like. I was at a PD recently and the person running it kept on saying, like, if you don't want to participate in this part of the PD, that's okay. You don't have to do this thing. And I was thinking, like, yeah, you could say that, but like, I'm not going to say that. If you're at the PD, like, how about we just go 100% and see what you get out of it? So this is kind of quite related to what you're talking about here. I particularly like the top right quadrant, something you think is highly likely to have an impact on learning and that already matches what you currently do. And your comment there was, can you do more of this thing that you're already doing that you're finding impactful? Well, that was my paraphrasing of what you said. And that really relates to a point Josh made in a few of our coaching workshops around, like, what should you coach someone on? And if you pick something they're already good at, especially when you start coaching, pick something they're already good at, turn them into an absolute superstar at it. And then suddenly your school has someone who's just got like the tightest mini whiteboard, checks for understanding possible, and they're a model for everyone else. So I think, you know, it's not just beneficial for the person who you're working with, but it's actually beneficial more widely. I really like the question, how could you do this better for something that already matches what you're currently doing or but has a potentially a low chance of impact on learning? A question I had was, in your PDs, do you think there will be much that teachers say, oh, there's a low chance of impact on learning from that? Because I would have thought, I mean, I've been reading Tips for Teachers recently, Craig, and there's not much in there that I think would have a low impact on learning. But I guess it gives people an out, to a cached out, in that they can say, well, I don't want to pursue that. But then you're forcing them to say, why is that?
I want to avoid the out that they can dismiss it, but I want to try and strike the balance, because the kind of the opposite of that is you have to try and do everything. I'm telling you that this is going to be impactful, so you do everything. And there's a lot, what I try and do in my PD these days is I give teachers a lot of ideas, and I want them then to have that agency to think, okay, these are 11 ideas here, but you know what? One and two are the ones that really appeal to me here, so I want to run with that. With then the hope that once they nail one and two, actually, you know, also, maybe I try idea seven now. Now I see that it actually is talking a bit of sense here, or maybe idea 11, as opposed to, yeah, here's a load of ideas. You know, there's no prioritization, there's no hierarchy. I think giving teachers that bit of agency, but also without that easy out, I think probably strikes the right balance. But as I say, You're the first person I've run this by. I tried talking to Isaac about it. He wasn't having any of it. So I'm running it by you. Just as because I'm going to try this in PD over the next 6 weeks and just see whether it leads to, my hope is that as I circulate the tables whilst people are discussing, it leads to some really interesting discussions about why people have put things in certain quadrants, whereas their neighbor, who perhaps just teaches the same subject in the classroom next door, they've put it somewhere else, as opposed to what was currently happening when I was circulating around, is a teacher was saying, oh, I really like idea number two. And the other teacher was like, oh, I really like idea number three. And it wasn't really, there wasn't really that dialogue. One teacher's talking about their idea, the other's talking about their idea, and there wasn't really that communication. Whereas my hope is, this will provoke a bit more of a kind of, yeah, structured, insightful dialogue between delegates. That's the plan anyway.
That's great. I mean, any framework or structure that pushes people to think more deeply about something, I think is really powerful and a great idea. So I'm making a note, Craig, to follow up with you next time. How did the structure go?
Yeah, I'm trying it first time on Friday, so a couple of days' time. So yeah, next time we talk, I'll definitely have rolled it out a few times.
Right.
All right, mate. So that is, over to you. What's your second idea for us today?
Second idea. Well, you might recognize this idea, Craig Barton, author of Tips for Teacher, because it is indeed from Tips for Teachers.
Oh, nice.
I tweeted the unsolicited tweet the other day. I don't know if you saw it.
Oh, it's lovely that. Thank you.
I think all new teachers should have this book, because it is, like, it's so well structured and it's really concise as well. Like, I've read a lot of books on teaching, so often reading them word for word gets quite laborious, but you've structured it and the headings are so clear that I can actually really just skim it and be like, yep, I've seen that before. You know, why have I seen that before? No, I don't. Maybe I should use your quadrant when I'm going through your book. Your quadrant's when I'm going through your book, Craig. But and then I can see something. Oh, I haven't seen that before. And then I can really drill down, and it's concisely written, and it's great. I've been absolutely loving it. I'm about halfway through it now. This one is the idea of asking who got 8 out of 10. And so, I mean, I'm obviously going to do a bad job of recapping this because you wrote about it, but you can tell me what I get wrong. You said that you originally got this idea from Tom Sherrington. And the idea is that it can be hard to ask or to get students to share something they've struggled with so that you can kind of unpick that answer. Obviously, whole class feedback is really powerful if you can get a mistake which is common and dissect that with students, talk about why it might be a mistake and help them understand how to do it correctly and avoid making that same mistake in future. But often it can be hard if you say, you know, who struggled with, is there a question that anyone had? Often, you know, no one wants to volunteer. So the idea that you shared with me and Tom Sherrington shared with you is we can ask the question, who got 8 out of 10? So you say, who got 8 of 10? Isaac puts his hand up. You say, Isaac, that's fantastic. You got 8 out of 10. Well done. I'm just wondering, what was one of the two that you struggled with this time? And so the benefit here is you're kind of giving Isaac a pat on the back because he's got a score that demonstrates some level of mastery or proficiency, but it's also an in to then dissect a question, which if it was a challenge for Isaac, it's probably a challenge for other students in the class as well. And then you emphasize how once that's happened and you've started to normalize the idea of errors as learning opportunities, you can then open up to more general questions like, are there any other questions people struggled with that we'd like to go down? So I thought this was really powerful and just a nice little trick to have in the teacher's toolbox. One reservation I had was I was wondering if we are already doing really effective kind of checks for understanding using mini whiteboards and things like that. I would hope that a teacher doesn't have to ask questions like, what's a question we struggle with? Because they would know from robustly checking all students' answers. However, that being said, I know that that's not always the case, and there will always be situations where maybe you're tight of time, or maybe another teacher's borrowing the whiteboards, or maybe the half of them are broken, or the caps have been off after the holidays, or whatever it might be. So I just thought it was a nice one to have in your toolbox.
Yeah, thanks, Holt. So I have a few things to say about this. I'm really pleased you brought this up. So there's kind of a lethal mutation of this and an effective way, I think, of using it, which addresses your kind of reservation. So the lethal mutation of this is, and I see teachers do this all the time, and I've done this so much. So let's say you set kids 10 for freeze, a 10 question, low stakes quiz or whatever, and the kids mark it themselves. And at the end you say, hands up, who got 8 out of 10? And like, almost all hands in the class go up and you say, oh, amazing, you've done really well. Okay, let's crack on. And the problem with that, of course, is everybody may have got the exact same two questions wrong. There could be major misconceptions in the class. And this is the danger of aggregation. As soon as you start aggregating scores, particularly when it's across loads of different domains, you lose the specificity of where the problems are. So if it stops with that data collection, who got 8 out of 10, this is a terrible idea because God knows what's kind of hiding underneath the aggregation. But to address your point, you are absolutely right that what's going to trump this every single time is whole class responses on mini whiteboards. But here's how I use this technique now, right? So let's say, for example, that the class have been working on a set of 20 questions for 15 minutes. They've been doing independent practice, and it's now time for me to review the answers. Now, what I'm not going to do is to get them to put every single question on their mini whiteboards and hold it up because time's not going to permit it and blah, blah, blah. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to do this new trilogy that I'm working on. And I need a catchy name for this, right? So it's going to start off with the critical question. So this is where we've talked about in previous episodes, my book to board technique, where it's get students working books onto mini whiteboards to show it. So let's imagine that all the class have been working in their books on these 20 questions. What I'll have been doing when I'm circulating around and in my planning is I'll have identified one or two really critical questions, the kind of core questions that if the kids are getting this right, things are going okay, or perhaps they've got a little twist in the question or something. So what I'll do, once the kids have kind of worked through, I'll say, okay, stop everybody. We're going to go through the answers. Just before I put all the answers up, can you all write down on your mini whiteboards your final answer to question 4? Because question 4 is such an important question. Harvey, when you're ready, 3, 2, 1, show me. All right, we've all nailed question 4. Fantastic. Or, oh, we've got a bit of a problem here. Let me grab that board. And I'll do that for one or two questions. So I'll get that specific whole class data for one or two critical questions. So that's part one of the trilogy. So that's kind of book to board critical question. Part two of the trilogy is I'll put all the answers up on the board and I'll then let the kids kind of self-mark. Tick, 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 tick. But then I'll bring in this idea of 8 out of 10 at the end. So, or whatever the equivalent is, whatever's 80%. So I'll say, okay, hands up, who got 80%. Ollie, amazing. You've done so well there. Which questions did you struggle with, Ollie? And then we'll talk. And then anybody else struggle with those? And then we'll talk about it there. So it's that combination of the specificity that Book to Board does with the kind of practicalities of we're not going to be able to do that for every question, so let's self-mark. So then how can we then pull out what are the commonalities that Book to Board hasn't picked up, common difficulties that Book to Board hasn't picked up on, and that's where I think we use the 8 out of 10. So I think that's probably, for me anyway, the most effective way of kind of getting the best of both worlds, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, that's great, Craig. I would suggest that it's actually a four-step process because also had one at the start where you said you were circulating and identifying like the critical questions. So I think that's an interesting one. And I think that's nice. That's because the book to board thing is one that I use very frequently with starters. Say it's a 5-question starter or something past exam questions. And that's really quick and efficient. But you're right. If you're doing 20 or so questions, then it's going to be quite different. So that's good. A really, really powerful approach. Love it.
Nice one, mate. Good. Yeah, and thanks for the plug for the book as well. Always goes down well.
That's no, right.
Right. No,
we're up to you, I think.
Yeah. So time for rehearsal, Ollie, right? So we always like talking about this, right? So let me set the scene here. So for listeners who haven't tuned into our monthly conversation in the past, this has been a kind of ongoing change for me that I was, when I started really getting into coaching over the last couple of years, I was anti-rehearsal. I just thought it is so awkward. And for listeners who aren't aware, rehearsal is the stage of the coaching process where after you've kind of identified the change the teacher's going to make and you've planned when they're going to use that change, it's then let's actually rehearse what this is going to look like in principle. And for many reasons, I just didn't like it at all. The main one being I just thought this is awkward. This is really cringy. But also, Ollie, when I reflect on this, the other reason is I thought, I'm not sure it's that important, this idea of rehearsal, right? Because surely teachers, as intelligent adults, they can understand what we're talking about in this coaching session and they can then go ahead and put it into practice. So for ages, I just avoided this. And then a number of things happened. So one, I had a big conversation, well, several conversations with you about it. And then I also, when Peps came on and I just asked him outright, do I need to bother with rehearsal? He went mad. I was a bit scared of him, actually. He's quite scary, Peps, sometimes. And he said, yeah, you definitely do need to do rehearsal. And then I watched Josh in action at a PD session and we all did rehearsal together. And I thought, you know what, there's something in this. So anyway, I started building in rehearsal to my own coaching and really enjoying it. But then I had a really interesting experience that I messaged you about. So I did a day in a secondary school where I was training coaches to coach. And I've done a similar day in a primary school, but this was the first day in a secondary school. So the format of the day was really interesting. There was me and there was 4 teachers who were training to be coaches or trying to like improve their coaching. And we, on day one, we started the day with a little kind of session for me where I just described my coaching process. And then in the morning of day one, we each watched 4 other teachers teach from the school we were based in. And then in the afternoon, I modeled how I would coach those 4 teachers with the other 4 trainee coaches watching on. We did feedback and blah, blah, blah. And then day two, it was flipped round where this time the coaches took the lead in the coaching session. We watched the same 4 teachers. And then the coaches took a lead in the coaching sessions and I gave feedback and they gave feedback. And it was one of my favorite days I've had this year. As you said before, you end up learning more from these sessions than anyone does from you and so on. And it was mind blowing. But here's the interesting thing. So when I was out, rewind back to day one, just before we're starting the session, I outlined this process and I said, and then the final stage of the coaching process is rehearsal. And you could see on these other 4 teachers' faces, they were not up for this, right? And then one lady said, do we really need to rehearse? And I said, look, I used to ask that. I think we do, but let's see what happens. Let's see if there's anything that happens throughout the day that makes us actually think rehearsal's important. Let's just go for it. I said, I'm going to push him to rehearse, but let's see what happens. And Ollie, it wasn't just one thing that happened. There were 3 things that happened that made me and the other 4 coaches at the end of the day say, you know what, we have to rehearse. And I'm fully on board now. So I'll just briefly describe these 3 things, right? So the first one, there was a guy and I was watching him and he was doing exactly what you're talking about during the do now. the kids were writing in their books. And then he said, okay, let's go through question one. Anybody think they know the answer to question one? One confident girl put her hand up. She got it right. He said, everyone else happy with that? All the kids nodded. Yeah. And my kind of hypothesis was he doesn't have a clue whether the kids actually know how to do this or not. I took a load of photos of books. Kids were getting it wrong, left, right, and center. So in the coaching session, we worked on book to board. We worked on the kids doing it in their books. And then, okay, let's go through question one. Put your final answers 3, 2, 1. Show me. So and this was the interesting thing. I talked him through it. And it was like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay, that's fine. So I said, do you mind if we rehearse it? We'll be the kids in the class, you be you, and we'll just go. And he's like, oh. Like, and you could see he's thinking, as if I need to bloody rehearse this. It's obvious, right? But it was really interesting. So we did question one, and we all got it right and held it up. And he was fine with that. He was like, congratulating us and so on. But then when we put the answers to question two, two of the coaches got it wrong on purpose, held up the boards, and he froze. And he said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what to do in this situation. I said, well, that's okay. Board's down. Let's talk about it. So I said, one option is you could grab this board and discuss it. One option is you could get them to discuss with their partners. And we talked it through. Now, had he not rehearsed that, who's to say that when that happens in the lesson, he's going to freeze then, and then it becomes a bigger issue. So you've got 30 kids looking at you and so on and so forth. So there's example one where had we not rehearsed, God only knows what was going to happen. Okay, example one. Example two, this is my favorite one. So this was a teacher, brilliant teacher, and he was trying to explain to the kids. He asked this question during the lesson we were watching. He said, what's the word that describes when the order you multiply numbers doesn't matter? And he said that to the class. One girl put her hand up, said inverse. He said, no, that's not quite right. Another kid put their hand up and said commutative. And he said, yeah, that's right, commutative, and then moved on. So my hypothesis was that the other kids hadn't heard this because he hadn't made a big deal of it. They wouldn't know what this word was. So 5 minutes later, I asked five of the kids. One said inverse, which was interesting, the kind of the first wrong answer. One said community. That was a good effort, but not quite commutative. One said they didn't know. One said begins with T. Maybe they think commutative. And then one kid got it right. So anyway, in the coaching session, this was my critical evidence, and he was well on board with this. He said, yeah, I know, I haven't done that right. What should I do? So I said, why don't we do some call and respond? So why don't you break the word down, commutative, and get everyone to chant it back at you, and then you frame it. The order which we multiply doesn't matter, is means, and then they chant back commutative, and then you flip it around, commutative means, and they chant back the order we multiply doesn't matter. Have you got that? Yeah, got it. Said, do you mind if we rehearse it? And he was well up for it. He said, yeah, of course. So he stands up. And Ollie, it was mind-blowing, right? Because I thought I'd explain that so clearly to him. But what he then starts doing, he starts cold calling us. So he'd be like, Craig, repeat after me, commutative. And so I did it, commutative. And then he says, right, the order we multiply doesn't matter. That's commutative. Anna, you say that back to me. I think, what's he doing here? So I let him go through it, and then, you know, it took a minute or so. And then I said, I think something's got a bit lost in translation. It's probably my fault, this. I said, just sit down, watch me do it. And then I modeled the call and response. And he's like, oh, that's what you mean. You want everybody replying at the same time. And I thought, you know what, that's kind of classic, almost kind of like checking for understanding, right? The kids are nodding. Yeah, I get it. But unless they've rehearsed and done it, like, you'd never do that in a lesson. But I was doing it with coaching. So anyway, so then again, rehearsal, and he's on board. And the next lesson, he was amazing. I've got a video, an audio recording of it. The kids were chanting it back. It was amazing. Final example, because I know I'm prattling on too long here. Another teacher later on that day, we were working with her on doing what ifs. So this is where whenever the mini whiteboard suggests kids have nailed it and you've got a bit of time on your hands, you start doing what if. So it was expanding single brackets, and we were doing like, okay, so you can do two brackets, X plus one or whatever. What if the plus one became a minus one? Do that on your mini whiteboards. Brilliant. What if the 3 became a 4? Do it on your mini whiteboards. Nail it. And so we talked through this in the coaching session, and she's like, oh yeah, brilliant. Okay, I get this, like your variation theory. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. So I said, great. I said, I know she was quite shy, this lady. I said, do you mind just doing rehearsing it? Just kind of going through this sequence of questions on the board. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, fine. And you could tell she didn't think it was necessary. Anyway, again, it blew my mind, this all. So she's a really strong mathematician. But she's writing, she wrote the first bracket on the board and changed one thing for the second bracket. We all did it. Wrote the second question on the board, changed one thing for the third. Fine. The next one, she changed about five things. The sign was changing, the three was changing, a letter was changing. I thought, what's going on here? Anyway, we did it. And she went through the sequence and I said, and they were all on the board. And I said, just turn around, have a look at that. What do you think of that sequence? And she saw it straight away. She said, there's too big a jump between example three and example four. And she was like, I don't know why I did that, you know. I don't know why I did that. But here's the thing, right? Had we not rehearsed it, who's to say she's not going to do that exact same thing in the classroom? So those three examples for me really hammered home the importance of this rehearsal. Because otherwise, what we're relying on, just like, there's so many parallels with teaching kids, right? We're relying on kids, the teacher interpreting exactly what we're saying in the way, you know, we intend it to be interpreted. But unless we have that check for understanding that rehearsal brings to us, we've no idea whether that's true. And it just bridges that gap between the theory and the enactment in class. And the most powerful thing for me from this was that both the teachers who were being coached and the coaches, their biggest takeaway from the end of the day, as well as the kind of hypothesis critical evidence being important, was how important that rehearsal was. And we went from a kind of group of rehearsal skeptics to, right, if we don't rehearse, it's going to really reduce the impact of our coaching. So I thought you'd enjoy that story.
I did, Craig. That was fantastic. A few responses. Couldn't agree more that it's a tragedy, or the way you put it there is it would really reduce the impact of the coaching if that rehearsal didn't take place. I think there's another negative impact of missing rehearsal, which is as important, if not more important. And that is, so imagine if that teacher or those three teachers had not done the rehearsal and then implemented that in the class the next time. The negative impact of that is not only, you know, some potentially lost student learning, there's also a view about the efficacy of coaching that comes out of that for the coachee and for the coach. The coach sees that and they're frustrated. They're like, how on earth did he or she get that out of my really clear model, right? And so they're faced with a situation at the start of the next coaching conversation where they either have to say, oh, I didn't explain it clearly enough, or you didn't listen carefully enough, or, you know, and you know, let's stay on this action step because we haven't quite nailed it yet. And suddenly what's gone from what could be a really great start to a coaching relationship where you've got momentum, you know, they're feeling like a sense of achievement and they're excited for the next action step. It's like, okay, well, let's just tread some water again. And the coach is stressed that they're going to make the same mistake next time. The coachee feels like, you know, the coach is doing a bad job because they didn't explain it well. And suddenly coaching starts to fall down in your school. So it's so powerful that came out so strongly and so clearly when you actually did it. And it's such a powerful PD model that you've got to actually do that live coaching. That's fantastic. Two things that I hypothesize might strengthen this coaching cycle that you're doing already and might help circumvent some of those initial errors that did take place, if I may, Craig.
Yeah, please.
The first one is a question. When you did those rehearsals, I'm wondering if they were based upon the lesson that you just saw or the next lesson that the teacher was going to teach.
Yeah, so I try and do it so it's always based on what they're about to do next. So the only exception to that was the commutative example, because I wanted him to, I don't think the kids had nailed that vocabulary, so he was going to go back over that in the next lesson. But great, the other two were based on what was coming up, yeah.
Great. So you're obviously on top of that. And for the benefit of listeners, you always want to be planning doing your rehearsal around the next lesson, because obviously the previous one, they're probably not going to teach that again for a year. Focus on the next one, and that's going to increase the probability it's going to transfer effectively. The second one is the idea, at StepLab, we don't just call it rehearse, we actually call it plan and rehearse. And so we would always, before the rehearsal, we will get the coachee to explicitly script exactly what they're going to say, or in the case of kind of that variation, we will get them to plan how they would vary that example. Is that something you did, or in a couple of them?
No, she was really confident that she could just do the kind of changes a myself. And again, that's on me to say, yeah, actually, let's plan these out together. Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Ol. That would help the situation.
Yeah, so that's just a really, really helpful thing. So if they script it, you can provide feedback on the script, and then you can go from there. But the thing is, like, sometimes people are just really keen to go for it, right? And if they are like that teacher, and they're like, oh no, I got this, I'm happy to go, I don't think there's any harm in saying, okay, sure, go for it. Because, you know, they might actually nail it first time. And if they don't, you can just do exactly what you did and say, step back, have another look at that. What do you notice? And then, so it doesn't matter that much, as long as the scripting happens within the process such that whatever they practice, it's actually getting refined and being ingrained, so that when they go into the classroom, they've got something really concrete to implement. But yeah, so there are two ideas, just summarizing for listeners. Plan forward for based upon the next lesson, and make sure you really script it and nail down exactly what they're going to say and do. But apart from that, that's great. And thanks for those stories. And I'm definitely going to be cutting out this portion of the podcast and sharing it around various places when the discussion about rehearsal comes up.
Nice. I've written it up as one of my ED newsletters as well, with the actual examples they used and so on and so forth. So feel free to share. And final thing for me, you're not bad at this coaching. You should consider doing some PD on it yourself, maybe. Yeah, some good insights there. Indeed, not bad at all.
Indeed,
not bad at all. All right, mate. What have you got next?
All right, my final takeaway for today is move slowly. So this idea, I learned this from a hippie. When I was at university, I was very involved in environmental activism. And as part of that, I was part of a group who was running a national conference for, I think, about 500 people came. It was a 5-day conference. Camping out in fields, feeding everyone, lots of sessions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, before this, I had been doing some work with an organization called the Oak Tree Foundation, which is like a youth kind of world poverty addressing organization. We'd run a heap of events, and every event we ran was always really high stress. And I always finished it feeling like, oh, I'm totally burnt out. That was really stressful. I couldn't think straight when it was happening and so on. And that was the experience for everyone else within this foundation that I was involved in. Great foundation. I learned a lot there as well. When I was doing this next big event, the national conference, this guy, Brett, was on the team. And he came to all our meetings in bare feet. he wrote all his minutes on a used envelope from the post that he'd, you know, taken the letters out of, and he just scribbled on the back with the stub of a pencil, and various other things about him that I won't necessarily share on this podcast. But an amazing guy. But the biggest learning for me for this whole conference, you know, organizing this 5-day thing, there were heaps of things we learned, but the main thing with me was I noticed how Brett moved very purposefully throughout the whole conference. And that was, as I kind of alluded to earlier, he moved really slowly. And he was doing that on purpose because the way that you move can influence your physiology. I was actually reminded of this takeaway in a number of ways. I was reminded of it running these four events around Australia over the last 2 weeks. One of the kind of tech guys from one of the schools who was helping us out, he kind of came up to me when we arrived and was like, oh, what's going on? What do we need to hook up first? You know, and his energy, I was just like, whoa, that's really interesting. And I purposely like moved slowly and talked more slowly around him to try to bring down the energy. And then Holly, just when we were having dinner tonight, she said, oh, you know, we were kind of reflecting on our days. And she said, yeah, today I realized that I was moving quite quickly and I was already a bit stressed. And the fact that I was moving quickly was like making me more stressed. And so I think whenever we are in a stressful situation, especially organizing an event or something like that, just taking a moment to move slowly can really help. Dr. Mark Dowley and I, in our forthcoming book on classroom management, also talk about this in terms of managing a class that's kind of starting to get a little bit unruly. Often it's the case that it isn't the whole class that's becoming unruly. It might be 2 kids, 3 kids, 4 kids, 5 kids, a couple of hotspots, maybe 3 hotspots. And if we let ourselves get sucked in to the kind of stress of the situation, what we can find ourselves doing is our eyes will dart in like a pattern around the hotspots. It'd be like, oh, those kids are off task. Yeah, they're off task. They're off task. Oh, they're still off task. Oh, they're still off task. Oh, they're still off task. And you find you're kind of tunnel visioning in on the hotspots of the class, and you feel like everything's going wrong. But something I worked out I can do in line with this idea of move slowly is just start, do a systematic scan from one side of the class to the other. If I feel like things are kind of going a bit out of control, and I can go, I just tell myself on task, on task, on task, off task, on task, on task, off task, on task, off task, on task, on task. And by the time I've finished that, one, I've just slowly scanned, so that moving slowly has helped me to relax. And also, I've got a much more accurate sample of how many students are actually on task and how many are off task. That helps me regulate myself, and then I can bring that energy to help regulate the class. So yeah, from looking after babies to running Enviro conferences to try to get an unwieldy class under control, I think this idea of moving really slowly and moving really purposefully can be a really powerful technique for us as teachers and in many other roles for down-regulating ourselves and handling potentially stressful situations.
Oh, so good on this, Al. Right, a few reflections on this. So I'm bad at this, you know. So anytime I do CPD, and they always ask me, what kind of tech setup do you want? I always want one of those clip-on mics because I love to move, and I'm marching up and down, and I like measure my steps on my watch. I've normally banged out easy 7,000 or 8,000 in a few hours CPD because I'm just bombing around the whole place and I'm marching up and down, and I do it, I think, to try and drive the energy up because I almost feel myself kind of making points to the rhythm that I'm stepping and so on and so forth. But you're right, you know, and I'm scribbling loads of things down here because I've just remembered I did a CPD, I don't know, it was a month ago, something like that, and they only had a lectern with a kind of static mic, and I'm thinking, oh my God. But it was one of the best things I've done because it forced me to slow down. I could think more carefully about the words I was saying. I was much more deliberate in the kind of pace I was using, the gestures I was using, and so on. And if you read Adam Boxer's work about kind of standing at Pastor's perch and observing the class and just taking a few moments to allow golden silence to settle, it's all about just slowing things down and getting this kind of robust, quiet, considered culture in the classroom. So I think there's a load in this, Ollie, you know, and this is something I'm going to have to really reflect on. And so as I said to you, I'm doing PD on Friday. Maybe I'll ask them for that static lectern, you know, and I'll be deliberate about this. And I'll just, now I've got this in my head, I'll observe the impact it has on how carefully considered I am with my words, because I think I am a bit too frenetic with this. Maybe I do need to slow things down. That's good, Alf. That's one of your better ones, that. I like that one. That's very, very good.
There you go. Glad to hear it, Craig. Glad to hear it. What's your final one, mate?
Yeah, so this is a question that I don't know the answer to, but it comes back to something we've been talking about. So I want your take on this. So do you remember, I can't remember what episode it was, maybe the second one we did or something like that. We both had ideas around shared lesson resources. And you even went crazy, right? You were going so far as to say that you had these shared PowerPoints that were, all the solutions were animated, and I was very much, one of my previous tips was about live modeling and so on, and it was all kicking off, right? But I'm always of the opinion, and I think we kind of agreed upon this, and this is something I've changed my mind about since I first started my career, that if you've got novice teachers, it's a really valuable thing for them to have some shared kind of high quality PowerPoints, let's say for an example, that they can then base their lessons around, and that their challenge then should be to try and adapt that PowerPoint to suit the needs of their students. So I was sold on this. I'm thinking, yeah, of course. And every time I visit a school and I have a meeting with heads of department, I'm always interested in what support, planning support, there is available for their less experienced teachers, are the shared resources, and so on and so forth. But there's a big twist coming here. So I've watched quite a few lessons recently that have been delivered by novice teachers using these shared resources, and it's not been good, Ollie. It's not been good. So it's been the classic, let's say, for example, this PowerPoint was 30 slides long. The idea being that it can be used with a bottom set or a top set, but you've got to adapt it. So with the top set, maybe you go a bit quicker, maybe you skip a few slides out. With the bottom set, maybe you supplement it with a few extra questions and so on. What I've watched quite a few teachers do is they just go through it from slide one through to slide 30. And I'm thinking, what's, and obviously never get to slide 30, right? Because the lesson runs out and so on and so forth. So here's my question for you, Ollie. What do you think is the more challenging skill for a novice teacher? Is it A, to adapt a pre-planned lesson to meet the needs of their kids? Or is it B, to plan a lesson from scratch to meet the needs for their kids? And I'll preface this with, if you'd have asked me this 2 months ago, I would have 100% been saying that option A is the one to go for. That's what we want people doing. But the more I see, I think it's incredibly difficult to adapt something because you don't know what to leave out. You don't know what to include. And they end up just leaving everything in. But I'm just interested in your take on.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. It's a really interesting question. I think there's potentially two questions we need to ask. One is the one you asked me, which is what's the more challenging skill for a novice? And the other is like, which one's most likely to be have the most positive outcome for students?
Absolutely.
Which I think is implicit in your mind when answering that question anyway. In terms of what's the most challenging skill, it's clearly, well, I would say it's writing a quick example lesson from scratch because they have to put effort in and it's not challenging to just click through a PowerPoint, right? So it's definitely more challenging. Which one's more likely to give a positive outcome for students? It's a really good question. And I would love to see, because it could be a question, it could be the fact that those teachers would have really struggled regardless of which approach. So it would be very, very interesting to go back to that school and say to one of those teachers, all right, can you teach another lesson, do it however you want, and see what happens. And I honestly don't know, because I've seen these shared lesson plans, they're not as popular in Australia as yet, at least. And so I haven't seen them used poorly much because I haven't seen them used that much at all. And usually the schools who are doing them are the schools who are high achieving already, and they have all the supports around it to make sure that teachers are actually getting the most out of them. But I've definitely seen lots of not particularly effective lessons that teachers have planned themselves, right? I would anticipate that having a well-planned lesson reduces one of the variables that can detract from the efficacy of a lesson, which is the actual planning, the other of which is the kind of in the moment abilities of the teacher and the performance of the lesson and so on. But yeah, you might be right. It may actually, in some cases, encourage people to essentially be lazy and basically do no preparation and therefore just rock up and click through. It's definitely. It looks like you want to say something to
that. Yeah, just on that, my sense, because that was my thinking. That's the problem. And of course, with a lot of teachers, that is the problem. The first time they know that this PowerPoint's available, so the first time they look at it is when they go into a lesson and they're clicking through and they're like, what the hell's this? What I found interesting with these teachers, I don't think it was that. I just think they lacked the ability to filter. They had these 32 slides in front of them that were, every slide had something good on it. And they just couldn't think what to leave out. So they just included everything. And the lesson was just a mess because they were either going too fast through things or were not getting to really critical things because they were, you know, doing three slides where a more experienced teacher would probably just spend one slide on it. So they were spending 25 minutes instead of 2 minutes. So it wasn't the laziness is definitely a potential problem, but it wasn't that with these teachers. It just dawned on me just how hard it is to adapt something versus actually if the teachers didn't have that, but instead, let's say they had a list of 4 or 5 websites that they knew had good stuff on it, or in a shared area, there was kind of 4 or 5 kind of well-established sources of things. And in fact, their job was to piece the bits together. I just thought, you know what, that's probably a bit easier for them to do and probably going to lead to better lessons because it's going to be more bespoke to their kids because they're creating from scratch. But that's completely counter to what I would have said a month ago. I don't know if that makes sense. So it wasn't laziness for me. It was more the difficulty of adaptation.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So I guess there's two things in my mind which make me potentially not quite as unnerved as you are about the whole idea of shared resources. That being said, I didn't actually see these lessons, so maybe if I actually saw them, I'd be equally unnerved. The first is that if we do leave it up to teachers to plan from scratch each time, there's actually no mechanism for us to kind of iteratively improve and, you know, build up a shared database of what actually really, really works within a school and kind of manage that knowledge. And so you're always trapped into this hamster wheel situation where every new teacher is planning, and I don't see a way that can be a strong foundation for consistent improvement within a school. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the question I'm considering at the moment is which of these two teachers, say if they could actually be supported with an effective coach once a week, once a fortnight, would be able to make progress more quickly to a proficient or really highly effective lesson. And to me, it's quite clear that if it is a quality lesson plan, providing that teacher with at least a bit of support from someone who can give them some guidance about how to adapt it and use it in an effective way, you know, within five or six coaching sessions, I reckon you could really have some massive impact on that teacher, and they could probably be teaching pretty good lessons within that period of time. If, however, they're having to plan their lessons as well, I would anticipate it's going to take a lot longer because you're going to have to provide a lot of input around clarity, how to structure examples effectively and so on before you can start to get to more of the kind of responsive teaching content. So that would be the second reason why I still feel that high quality shared resources is probably a better way to go.
I think you're 100% right. And just to build upon that, I think the mistake lots of departments make, again, I can only speak for the ones I visit, is they think they've done the hard work, so they've built these shared lesson plans. But if the support stops there and the support doesn't carry on to supporting teachers to adapt those lesson plans, you're running a big old risk. And I think, again, a lot of these shared lesson plans take a long time to put together and so on. So head of department thinks, what could possibly go wrong with this? But it's classic curse of knowledge, right? You know, it's one thing if you've been teaching 10 years to think, well, if they've got slide two, let's skip out slide three. But if it's the first time you're teaching this and your head of department has produced slide two and three, well, it's probably because he wants me to use them both, right? So I'm going to use them. And I just think adaptation, it's a slightly underrated how challenging that is as a skill.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. And I think it's a powerful message to people and to us as well, just to think it's all well and good to put heaps of time into these shared resources, but the support cannot stop there. It reminds me of, I just had Sam Gibbs on the podcast talking about a concept-led English curriculum, one of my favorite kind of episodes, and because we went so deep into a really effective curriculum planning and it was fantastic, and I don't think about English enough, and it is a really kind of fantastic discipline. But she really emphasized the importance of really bringing, if you are shifting from what most schools are doing right now to more of a concept-based curriculum, she really emphasized the importance of bringing teachers along with you and actually involving them in that process. And I think it's the same with shared lesson plans. You know, if a head of department's just going to sit back and write all these lessons and then whack them onto a shared drive and say, use these now, it's just not very likely to be successful. So the idea of working together on it is likely to lead to much more fruitful outcomes. The final thing I'd say is the word you're using about this is adaptation, adapting them, which is interesting. To me, maybe that is the most accurate word, but it's not the one that I've traditionally used. I would say using them effectively, because when we use the word adapt, to me, that's more about actually changing them. Like, it's a teacher thinking, oh, tomorrow I'm teaching this. This is the lesson plan. How am I going to change it for my class? But from the way you're describing there, I heard more, it was more about like using them responsively with the students. So I was just wondering about that, whether that's the word adapt is the best one we can use to articulate this challenge, or whether it might send people down the wrong
That's wrong interesting. Route. Yeah, I've not thought about that way. Yeah, I get this classic curse of knowledge, right? Because I'm thinking, of course, you've got to be responsive in the lesson. But I'm thinking more here of, let's make sure before the lesson we've had a look at this PowerPoint. And immediately we may think, either I'm not going to use that for whatever reason, or I need to supplement it with something else so I've got that ready on my sleeve. So that's where I was thinking more of the adaptation before the lesson. But then, yeah, of course, the responsiveness in the lesson. Yeah, I think that's a worthwhile distinction, absolutely.
Yeah, because the way you told that story then, it sounded, I mean, the mistake you said they were making is just going through every slide, right? And I mean, if the slideshow is set up in such a way that it does have great scaffolding, then it's basically just the speed with which you go through it and the slides you choose to use.
Yes.
That's all that's required to adapt, quote unquote, adapt it to that class, which is basically just responsive teaching. So yeah, I just thought it was worth pulling that out.
That's a fair point. Well, there we go, mate. There was six good ones there. I really enjoyed that.
Got a bit serious at the end there, though.
Yeah, we haven't had a little daft end. We started off with your one with your timer dice. Do you remember that one you had to kind of kick start things with
That was a daft one, was it?
Well, you know what I mean. So, yeah, well, I'll make sure for next month we have something a bit more lighthearted for number six. That was good.
Oh, good, mate. All
right,
good.
Al, so we're going to, in a moment, we're going to record our special kind of thing for your Patreon listeners where we're going to reflect on podcast episodes that teachers should check out. But anything you would like regular listeners to check out, all of yours?
I'll do the usual plug, Craig. If people are looking for yet another newsletter with some interesting ideas each week, check out EdThreads, which we'll make sure we link to in your show notes.
Certainly will. And again, yeah, listeners, for me, newsletter will be the thing for me. Obviously, I want to go one better, and also I've got two newsletters, my Tips for Teachers and my ED newsletter. A little teaser alert. So, in a previous ED newsletter I wrote about rehearsal that me and Al talked about, I've got an absolute corker coming up. I don't know when I'm going to release it. I need a big clickbait title. It's going to be something like green pen corrections don't lead to learning, or ban the green pens, or something like that. And I've got some photos of just how much correcting in green pen can hide understanding. And it's just, I don't know if you have it in Australia, but it is rife in England. If you don't understand it, just correct it in green pen. And it's absolute nonsense. So I'm going to do a big piece on that in a couple of weeks. So watch out.
Sounds good, guys. I'm excited.
All right. So yeah, thank you for tuning in. And me and Ollie will be back next month. But for now, it's bye from me.
And bye from me as well, I guess.
Smooth as ever. See you later, everybody.